Hello and welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. I'm very happy to be back with the podcast that takes a Bowie album through the chat ringer with a guest who knows a thing or two about it. In this episode, I'm delighted to welcome back Leah Cardos for the second instalment of our conversation about 2013's The Next Day. A long, well, very long album by Bowie standards. It clocks in at around 50 minutes, and it's nevertheless a remarkable late classic. It's really soaked in piss and vinegar. The tone is ripped and muscly, and it's got exceptionally Baroque, diseased lyrics. And overall, as I've discovered while preparing this podcast, it really does repay close listening. Anyway, so this is part two, and excuse the pun, where are we now? In the first part of the conversation, we got as far as that track. Now we're going to pick up as Leah and I encounter the deceptively dark groover Valentine's Day. So here we go, and I hope you enjoy. Let's start with Valentine's.
It's still in that run of like really strong songs in the first half of the album, The Next Day. So, you know, it's also probably the scariest song I think on the record, and that's saying something because there's some really scary songs on that record.
Yeah. I mean, I'm quite taken aback. You think this one's the scariest because it's got some stiff competition.
Well, it's scary, I think, because it's just so goddamn catchy. And, you know, and it's so bouncy and the music is so poppy and Beatles-esque, and it's all that sugary confection, but then you've got this kind of really quite evil protagonist. It's not really a protagonist, is the right word, right? An antagonist singing the lyrics, and, you know, the video as well, with that sort of evil, maniacal look on his eyes. I find it more chilling.
And he's got what's the guitar? The very minimal guitar. It's a Hohner.
Yeah, it's a Hohner guitar, isn't it? Yeah.
It's a Hohner guitar. And he's throwing these shapes on there which are casting shadows, which are very similar to rifles.
It looks like
a
rifle.
So there's no doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no doubt what's going on there. But do you know what I found? I'm sure you know this. I found this interesting little factoid, which is by Marcus Klinko said this, which is originally when Bowie was doing this video, he wanted to reverse age, like in that Brad Pitt movie. He basically wanted to start out as an old man, like 80, and reverse in special effect and be like 19 at the end of the video. It was kind of tough to talk him out of it. He really wanted it that way.
I've never heard this.
We cast a young version of him, a lookalike, a model that was really talented, that was used for some of the shots, like the scene from the back when he's looking through the window. That's actually his younger body double. We decided not to do that with him, and I felt it was a little cheesy to do it. It was the only time I ever really talked him out of doing something. Many of the other ideas for the record packaging, all that, a lot of it was his ideas. So yeah, Bowie had this like pretty fixed idea of reverse aging, which adds another dimension to this, doesn't it? You know, like it's quite a dense narrative around this song.
Well, I mean, sorry, my brain is processing that information. I was making me think of the Thursday's Child video, you know, where there's that reflection, that younger reflection in the mirror. And also just makes me think of The Next Day in general, how it is just, you know, going back and using Bowie's lexicon, his, you know, his career and his images and his sounds as, you know, expressive tools to paint with. So that does sort of change it up a little bit. It would have made it maybe, I don't know, it would have put another edge on it, right? It would have been really prismatic.
It would have been hyper-prismatic. And I think with a song like this, where the inspirational subject matter is so dark and so topical as well, you know, looking back on this, I think in the years running up to the recording of The Next Day, probably the biggest US mass shooting was Virginia Tech. It's still the biggest, has the highest death toll of school shooters.
Right.
And I just thought, let me see what were the big school shootings around, say, the time he might have been writing this. So I went on Wikipedia, and it's very sobering. They actually have, by decade. And you go through them, you're like, Jesus Christ. It's literally like every few months, sometimes more than that.
It's like clockwork. Another one rolls
and
around.
Bowie would have had many, many, many examples to choose from. And in some cases, as with Virginia Tech, the perpetrator was, you know, the archetypal angry loner. People reported that, you know, he'd be wearing all in black and he would have been characterized as the misfit, and other kids might have laughed at him. And the character here in Valentine's Day is very much painted like that. I think either Visconti or Bowie said that, you know, he's... Hang on, in fact, I have Visconti's quote about this from the time. It's about mental health rather than gun control. It's all young people doing these shootings. It goes on inside the head of the shooter. David gives him the name Johnny, which I think is the name he's given to about 12 people in his songs over the past 40 years.
Johnny the American.
Maybe it rhymes well. A generic name which helps describe the common man. But... Yeah. Interesting saying that, you know, that here we're shifting the emphasis. Bowie was shifting the emphasis from guns. So there is that narrative in the video that finally got made, but it's very much about the mental health of the shooter and attempting to try and articulate some of that fundamental imbalance, you know, some of the kinks and the weird twists that go on in that person's mind.
For sure. And also, if we think about the three words, isolation and revenge and osmosis, this sort of idea that those three words bring up this idea that, you know, once you isolate someone, then, you know, the mental health via osmosis, you know, you can be permeated, you can fester with ideas. And also, it has to be said that, you know, Valentine's Day is like the theme tune for Valentine from Lazarus, who is a linchpin in that musical, who is an antagonist that has a kind of almost incel sort of mentality, this kind of deep hurt because of their lack of love and their isolation, which speaks to the Tony Visconti quote as well, that it is much more about sort of the psychic isolation of a character as opposed to just, you know, gun control and the NRA.
Yeah. And he references that very strongly in the video. But then what we were just talking about now, Bowie's original concept for the video of himself, reverse aging. I'm also still trying to get my head around that.
I'm just reeling with that information like you are. But like thinking back to the subtle references to, you know, himself at a younger age in Where Are We Now and Love Is Lost, and thinking about sort of, you know, the evocation of the younger self, you know, at age 22. You know, this idea that loneliness can do such a number on you that it can actually, you can actually cause you to sort of, you know, fantasize about killing people, about trying to be powerful.
And in the Tony quote as well, he has that rather funny observation that, you know, he's used the word Johnny, was he says, about 12 times. Actually, if you look at it, you can say Bowie has used Johnny in repetition. He's used Johnny in I'm Afraid of Americans.
Johnny is a man. Yeah, Johnny's American.
And where else?
Johnny is American.
So repetition and I'm Afraid of Americans. And for 10 points.
Is there another one? Oh, this is some kind of like trivia question, isn't it?
You do know this. You do know this. But there's a slight twist to this question. So can you guess? Where's the other Johnny?
You're going to have to tell me.
All right, let me give you one clue. All right,
scanning through the lyrics of time right now. Yeah.
Bowie doesn't sing it. He co-wrote it.
Oh. Is it All the Young Dudes? No. Oh, right. Oh, that was tangential.
I'm going to cut that in the silence.
No, you can keep it. I'm not so proud.
I didn't get it either. I was just looking.
Did he co-write that lyric, though?
Pretty sure he did. I'm pretty sure he did. I do know he came up with the melody, but I would have to triple check.
That kind of scans, though, because all those Johnnies are kind of, you know, archetypes of, you know, just your everyman. You know, your normal person who's susceptible to the worst evil in the world.
Exactly.
You know, the worst violence. Johnny.
Johnny's just anyone. Johnny's just a regular guy. But in rock and roll, obviously, we go back to there's Johnny B. Good. There's all sorts of Johnnies in rock and roll. But I found one which I thought you might enjoy. So obviously, we have Johnny B. Good. We have Johnny and I'm Afraid of Americans. We have Johnny in repetition. But the favourite Johnny I found today is by Shonen Knife. Johnny, he's a regular boy. Johnny, he's a regular boy. He Johnny, 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 he's a regular boy. Johnny, 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 he's a regular boy. He's the nicest boy in town. He's good at archery. He's the nicest boy in town. He's the cleanest boy in town. He's good at dominoes. He's the cleanest boy in town. Yeah, 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 yeah.
The cleanest boy in town.
Good at archery, dominoes, and he's clean.
Yeah. I mean,
what more do you want? So.
Yeah, well, this idea of sort of, you know, Johnny being this archetypal rock and roll lyrical, you know, evocation of just absolute normality, just ordinary person.
So
I like that a lot.
Here we are with Johnny. And so Johnny is, you know, he's the character here. But I think it's a track that not only has this, you know, you talk about this deceptive melody, but it's got something of a sort of 60s feel about it as well, don't you think?
I think it does, you know, like there's, I mean, I think Chris writes about this in his Ashes to Ashes book about how there's like a kind of, he says Teddy and Judy, which sounds
Terry
a little bit
Julie.
Like Terry
Absolutely,
and Julie
yes.
from Waterloo Sunset. And there's a sort of 60s Britpop type jangle to it, which in turn reminds me of like reality, just the sound
right.
of it. It sounds really reality to me. This sort of take on Britpop, you know, or Brit rock. But yeah, the music, it makes it more sinister for me because the music is so sunny and major and bright, and you could easily like not dial into that lyric and just, you know,
yeah,
strut along to this song and think, oh, isn't this great? Oh, isn't Bowie great? You know, but actually it's so sinister, and it's even more sinister because of it. Because
You're
of
absolutely
that
right. That chorus at the end when he's just like punching those top notes and
those little sinister voices that woo and yeah, there's like childlike voices that he does, which are always for me always a signal to something to do with mental health.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, when he has the voice and he pitches it up or down. Yeah, yeah. And the video, I just find it so creepy. It would have been even more creepy if it was really young Bowie emerging like Benjamin Button style. That would have been
I'm kind of visualizing it now. You know that Vittel ad he did where he played all the different Bowie roles and they're all looking very young, something like that, where it's just weirdly young. Or like, you know, both of us have gone to see ABBA Voyage. Is it Voyage or Voyage?
Yes.
What do you say?
I like saying Voyage, but I've been told it's not, but let's use that because I prefer that.
It's like
that.
Going to see ABBA's Voyage, where they are these kind
ABBA
of
Voyage.
Ageless, slightly roboticized figures. I always get that when I get the tube home from work, there's a massive illuminated billboard as you go down the escalator of Voyage, and it can
Love
be
it.
Quite, depending on the kind of day you've had, it can be quite intimidating.
Well, there's this talk now. Isn't there this talk now because they've announced the V&A David Bowie Performing Arts School or whatever in Stratford, and someone in the Daily Mail has, you know, postulated, oh, maybe they're going to do a permanent David Bowie hologram performance a la ABBA Voyage. I think that's a horrible idea.
But apparently they could only do Voyage because they actually model them on the real people, unless you've got like a stand-in Bowie.
Yeah. They performed it.
Unless you got like a stand-in Bowie to come in and perform a set, which
you'd need to have like a body double that knows all the moves, who like gets put all those dots on like Gollum, and then like can just do the hologram performance. I don't know if I like.
If somebody had told us about Voyage 2 years ago, I think you and I and a lot of ABBA fans would be like, well, don't like the sound of that. Yeah,
I didn't like the sound of it. No, but
but you've been how many
alive.
Times?
I think
you've
that's
been
the
twice,
crucial
or
thing.
Is it three times?
Three times now. Three times. I know. I'm not even a big ABBA fan. I can't stop going.
What is it that keeps drawing you
back? I don't
know
what's wrong with me. I just end up crying my eyes out every time I go. It's just the really uncanny situation. I don't know, but like I go a couple of times. I've been very, very drunk when I've gone, but I've also been there sober. And it just, you know, there's a moment where you look around and you think, oh, the music is timeless, but it isn't. And these people are presented as their best youngest selves, and you look around and you see everyone who is, you know, of an age. You see lots of gay couples, lots of married couples, lots of women on nights out, and they're, you know, in their 50s and 60s with kids and generations underneath them. I don't know what broke me last time. I was in a seat last time. I wasn't in the dancing area, and I looked over and I saw this old guy, and he had a hearing aid, and he was he had his arm around his wife, and he knew every word to The Winner Takes It All, and he was singing with all his heart, and he had this glistening tear in his eye, and it just made me cry because I was like, music is timeless and we can be young forever. And, you know, this music connects to our memories and it's just so poetic and also just bloody weird as well. And you're looking around you and it's like, this is crazy. It's like a flat pack, you know, arena. It's just completely designed to manipulate you. But yeah, yeah, really gets to me that. It really does play with like my idea of time and space and what music means and what it can mean. But
so The Winner Takes All, but was there any other kind of standout moment there? I think The Winner Takes All for me, I get very sentimental with that song. I mean, I think I definitely had a tear or two when they sang that one. But is there any other particular moment?
Yeah, knowing me, knowing you, funnily enough, that whole sequence where they're kind of, there's these mirrors and the shards of the mirrors are breaking apart and they're kind of looking at each other and I just, all I can think of is like, what would it be like to sort of be married to this person and have that moment in your life, this brief moment, define the rest of your life, you know, and this relationship that hasn't been together for 40 years to define, you know, everything that you do from then. And then to have to keep on raking over those coals and it just, ugh. And the way it was all put together, it was just so beautiful. And yeah, and it's the beautiful, like, staging of it. It's beautifully done. Was it Johan Renck involved
in some
of that?
I'm sure he was. I think he had quite a major role to play in it for some reason. I think I saw a documentary or something about it and I thought, oh, it's Johan Renck. But he was absolutely involved. And
it's
I think what we're talking about here, I think it's only a matter of time, really. I mean, a lot of legacy artists, the estate's managing legacy artists, will be looking at the success of Voyage and thinking, well, there we go. You know, it hasn't flopped dreadfully. It hasn't been an embarrassment. It's actually worked. No. It's critically acclaimed. It's an experience. Here's what we do, you know, in decades hence. Beatles, Stones, Queen, Bowie, you know, Prince, you know, you can see this is how things are going to go.
Yeah, I feel some kind of way about it. I think if the guys in ABBA were deceased, I'm not sure I'd feel as comfortable with it the way it is. It'd feel more exploitative. I mean, it doesn't feel exploitative at the moment. It just feels, you know, just feels like a very weird, uncanny entertainment experience. But if, you know, if they made one of Elvis or Prince or Bowie or anyone that I'd missed seeing, yeah, I don't know. I don't know about the ethics of that. I'm not sure. When the artist isn't there to consent, you know, I feel weird about
it. But then people would say, oh, Bowie would have loved to have been involved in technology like this, or he would, you know, I get it. I know what you mean, but I'm also worried that it's going to happen. And that's why I said it's inevitable. Yeah. I mean, just the cynical part of me thinks it is inevitable. Briefly, but what are your thoughts on the V&A archive?
Well, I mean, my thoughts were kind of scuppered by, you know, someone released the press release a day early. So I was really just thinking, oh, I hope that person's not fired for like a whole day. I didn't really sink in until I saw the proper announcement the next day. And I was like, oh, wow, you know, that's a massive resource. And I just wonder how it's going to actually materialize. Like, is it going to be is it just going to be a David Bowie building, or is it going to be more of a pop music museum type thing? I don't know. I wonder how much it's going to cost to go. I wonder what the Institute of Performing Arts aspect of it is going to be.
Yeah, that one baffled me as well.
I've got a lot of questions.
That baffled me as well. What is going to be?
Or is it just the name of the archive and they're just using it for research in terms of you come here and study these costumes and then walk away knowing more about performing arts or something. I don't know.
I think we'll have to get somebody from the V&A to come on the podcast.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm excited. I'm happy about it, but I've got a lot of questions, you know. I'm just sort of, you know, putting it out into the universe. If Kingston can send me on a secondment there, I'd really like that.
Okay, nice. Let's see what we can do. Right. So one last thing I wanted to say about Valentine's Day, and this actually just relates to what you were mentioning earlier about Terry and Julie. So Jerry Leonard, who had been playing on the album, I've got a quote from here where he's talking about how Earl Slick and Sterling came down because those guys had been kind of out of sync for the main sessions and David wanted to include them. And he loved their playing and it's a very distinct thing. He'd earmarked a few songs and one of those is Valentine's Day, and it's totally Slick. It's Bowie, it's the Kinks, and Slick all wrapped up together. So, yeah, good...
Good
Kinks reference there.
Yeah, okay, yeah, another Kinks reference. It does feel quite Kinksy. It does feel quite London, you know. A really interesting track. It's really strange. I feel like it sticks out a little bit like a sore thumb on this record. Lyrically and thematically, it fits really well, but just musically, you know, like a few other tracks that come up in the second half, it's just like, wow,
yeah,
you know, that's a... That's a left hook.
It's that kind of killer sparkling melody. It's great. Absolutely great.
Yeah.
We can't use the term killer sparkling melody for the next song, which which I will preface.
Well, you could.
I mean, it's okay. So this is Crusade, Tyrant, Domination, and of course this is If You Can See Me.
Probably the most dense and puzzling track on the album, and that's saying something again.
So what's your take on this one?
Well, I really enjoyed analysing this from a music theory perspective because there's some clever stuff going on in terms of the way that it's constructed. Whether or not all of that adds up to like a satisfying pop music experience is another question. But in terms of it being a composition that does stuff, I find it really interesting. And it also seems to be one of the links that very subtly links forwards to the really chaotic, really dense music that comes, with Sue in A Season of Crime, and particularly, Bowie's demo version of 'Tis a Pity, She's a Whore, this kind of quite unrelentingly dark, very chaotic, very noisy, lots of things going on, your attention being pulled in lots of different directions. I feel like this song, more than anything on the next day, foreshadows that move.
It's a very good point, yeah. Nick Pegg has this theory that there's always one track on a Bowie album that paves the way for the next Bowie album. And this very much does that, yeah.
Yeah, I would say this, and also maybe the atmospherics of Heat, also maybe foreshadowing a bit of the sort of murky atmospherics of Black Star and Lazarus and stuff. But I find a lot to enjoy on this, just because I think this is David Bowie in his kind of music construction mode. You know, he's really thinking about, like, in the verses, he wants to build up this sense of confusion, and in the refrains, he wants to build up this sense of mounting inevitability. And then from there, just laying on too much makeup. There's just too much detail, you know.
Musically.
And it feels very Bowie-esque. Yeah, musically, like, you sort of have these. There's a lot of songs on the next day where the different sections of the song are in different keys, and he just stages these transpositions all the time, shifting position, shifting sort of the ground beneath your feet, moving you to different places. But on this, his voice changes between sections. He uses that, pitched up effect that I often associate with, as I said before, mental illness or, sort of the bending of reality. These sort of very speed effects that you hear every now and then. But notably on tracks like Scream Like a Baby, where the guy jumps in the furnace. And you've got that effect here too. And then, the same sort of breakneck beat that's sort of very Earthling-like, played by the same drummer from Earthling. And then you've got Gaylan Dorsey doing these vocalizations that are quite Earthling-like, thinking about Dead Man Walking. But then you got another bassist playing the bass. So it all just feels really clever. And that's what I kind of appreciate about this. But yeah, I'm not sure it actually works as like a song, that's just satisfying to
listen to. It's definitely the direction he explores again going further, and almost as a precursor to that. And I'm interested that you feel it doesn't quite pull it off with the assurance that he will do a few years hence.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit, you can feel the cogs moving with this. It just sort of starts out with that really strange polymeter, this idea where you've got like 4-4 and 5-4 at the same time, sort of grinding against each other. I mean, that as a listener, as particularly pop music so embodied, right? We want to be able to move our bodies to it. It's a frustration out from the off. So you're already grinding against this music going, what is going on? It already has you confused. You don't know where the one beat is. It's all just floating around, in space. And then add to that this lyric that's just like really dark, like super, super dark, comically dark.
It is comic. I'm glad you said that.
And it's hard to like sort of,
like, come on, this is so,
I mean, you can't just sort of like roll around in your car singing, I am the Lord of Theft,
I will slaughter really your kind who descend from belief. I am the spirit of a greed, a Lord of Theft. Yeah, exactly. It's not.
I will burn all your books and the problems they make. You can't really, join in with that sing along.
I mean, you could. I mean, so, you know, depends who's joining
you
in.
Could.
You know, it could be just the next thing for your next satanic mass ritual. But it's definitely you're right saying comical. You know, I'm definitely feeling this is almost satire. It's it's tongue in cheek. Yeah. You know, the rhetorical flourishes and like the endless piling on of this bleak imagery. But you know what? It really does. It made me think of The Man Who Sold the World. Like tracks on that, like Savior Machine. Yeah.
Savior Machine.
And so I went back to look at that. And it's interesting. So Tony Visconti, talking about this track in 2013, said he's tapping into his jazz roots. The song called If You Can See Me has a very wide, beautiful, crunchy jazz chords with time signatures that Dave Brubeck would be proud of. And then I was reading up about Savior Machine, and this is what Tony says about Savior Machine. In this song, we play a jazz waltz beat with a little nod to Dave Brubeck. Da-dun. Against the Mood, playing it. Yeah. Again,
you're right.
It's just, you know, that apocalyptic narrative. So Savior Machine, you know, has a bit more of a linear narrative. There's the prayer and it goes crazy and, you know, it's all very 2001. And here we have this
It's genocidal, though. It's the same. It's of the same. It's of the same section in his library, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Under genocidal.
The genocidal
all right, Tony,
section.
I've got genocidal. I want you to dial up the Brubeck. We're going back in.
But I mean, this is again one of these ones where I remember kind of liking it because it was clever and musical, and I was like, oh, I can hear he's doing all cool music things in this. But when I went back to look at it for the book, it was just really fun to dig into it. And rather than just note, well, that's evil lyric and that's a clever musical thing, and well, that's a very specific Bowie reference, to actually like sort of look at all of those things together and like, what is it actually saying? You know, what is the message? What is he trying to make you think about? Or what does the music make you think about is a more accurate thing to ask. If you look at a lot of this sort of archetypal stuff that he's working with, you know, he's really trying to sort of hold up a dark mirror. He's trying to sort of say, if you had power over somebody else, would you turn into a monster? And all the music supports this idea because the music is full of these unfair advantages. You know, you've got musical figures that are at a slower pace than others. So you've got this one that races ahead with bigger strides. You've got these musical ideas that just triumph no matter what. You've got other ideas that are behind, and this is all sort of leading up to this idea, which I feel like, you know, the climax is this weird sound design thing at the end, this kind of murky purple black dark mirror that's looking down in the ocean. This is depths. It's like, you know, he's sort of at the end of the song, he sort of does this pantomime evil villain act, and then he holds up this mirror, and it's that last moment of the song where it all makes sense, you know, and this idea of just like, actually it goes deep, it goes back a long way, and actually this is what human nature is, and what are you going to do to surpass it? This sort of archetypal tyrant. And I think, you know, it's fitting as well that this song is between gun songs, you know, between like Valentine's Day and I'd Rather Be High. It's like this sort of this little corner the album turns, and it's like the apex of that corner is this song, you know. Just keeping in mind that he went away and thought for months on end about the order.
No,
of
you
things.
Said that last time we spoke as well, and just when you bring this up now, it's wow, yeah, that is really interesting that this has been very deliberately inserted at this point in the overall narrative structure. And I like what you say about the end of the song representing this, you know, almost dramatic climax where it's an all-seeing, omniscient voice, very dark, Black Mirror-style thing. I think that's a really, really good reading of it. I also have this funny quote by Gail, and obviously she's playing on it.
Yes.
And she sings on it. Oh, sorry, she sings on it. Yes. And just to say what she thinks, what she's saying about it, it's a ridiculous time signature. It's 7/5 or something, a strange, looping, limping time signature that is really very cool. I love her description, limping. That's just about right, isn't it? It's very hectic and internally complex. Yeah. And I love this this musical metaphor that you're talking about, you know, it's the unfair advantage that some keys have over each other. That's such a cool way of reading it. And Gail thought the same thing. You know, it's just got this, it's ridiculous.
I'll tell you what's also ridiculous. There's, I hope you forgive me for this, but, you know, there were these like celebrating Bowie concerts, and there was some that happened in New York, and Tony and Woody, back when they were friends, they did a show together with all these guests. And there's a version of this, and you got to look it up. Okay. It's just, I mean, they tried it. They tried it.
Fair play. They tried it.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
okay,
yeah.
I'll have to check that out. Right then. Okay, so moving on to Indifference, Miasma, Press Gang. It's I'd Rather Be High.
I love this one. Do you like this one?
I love it.
Yeah, it's
got
really
that,
good.
Again, it's got like that this iridescent melody that's absolutely shimmering and gorgeous.
The songcraft. Ugh. Chef's kiss songcraft in this one.
Perfect songcraft.
Oh, yeah. Really
talk
good.
Us through the,
yeah.
Talk us through yep. the songcraft. Thanks. Well, thanks,
it's just really lovely. I mean, again, you've got this territorialized structure where you've got verses, they're doing versey things, you've got these choruses that really lift, you've got a beautifully placed bridge. I just think, you know, all of that's great, but then you look at the songcraft relating to the lyrics, and then you've got this lovely thing where the melody sort of apes what the lyrics are doing. Just really lovely. You've got this sort of strutting kind of militaristic sort of rhythm in the verses that builds to this really quite psychedelic chorus, which works on the word high. And it's so booky as well, which, like, the lyrical thing, that's really satisfying. Yeah, all the booky references in this one.
He starts
are really
off
good.
With, so already in the first few lines, he's referencing Evelyn Waugh and Nabokov, neither of whom I can pretend to be overly familiar with. There are people listening who are familiar with these books, but the Nabokov reference is very interesting. So again, we go back to our favourite city, Berlin, and this character is lying on the beach near Grunewald. Now, Grunewald is where, rather more prosaically, I used to take the dog for a run because there's a dog beach at Grunewald. That's obviously not what Beau is talking about here.
Is this from, like, the gift or something?
And the character...
Yeah.
The character,
I haven't read
The kind of the pass notes... Say it's in the final chapter. The character is.
I just let Chris O'Leary.
I know,
do all
he's
the
so good.
Ones,
he's
like,
so
know,
good. I feel that, you know, if Chris was on hand right now, he could wonderfully explain to us what this was about.
But oh yeah.
I can't even say the bloody name. Fjodor is elated and takes a walk in the Grunewald forest, where he imagines to have a talk with Konchiev. His clothes, including the key to the apartment, get stolen, and he has to return in his bathing trunks. Now, why Bowie decided to start the song with that, I don't know. But then he's talking about the book Officers and Gentlemen from 1955, where Claire and Lady Manners drink until
War.
The other cows go home, gossip until their lips are bleeding, politics and all. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do. So straight away, we're in there. I mean, there's something of the Aladdin Sane there, isn't there? You know, Aladdin Sane was very famously that sort of battle cries and champagne just in time for sunrise. You know, that sort of... kind of contained hysteria around wartime. Yeah.
I can hear that. Yeah, definitely. This kind of, and also just those really oblique references to choice bits of his favourite reading. I really like that as well. But then, of course, there's a sort of, you know, the image of a man training his gun on another man in the sand feels quite contemporary. It feels quite... You know, unless it's about sort of Gallipoli, or, you know, it could be like about, you know, the wars in the Middle East.
I think it's
21st century type thing.
I don't feel that he's referencing a specific war at a specific time. I think there's certainly that early 20th century feel to it, and, you know, that. But then it's like he wants to call up his ex for teenage sex. So I don't know if that's the sort of idiom that we'd imagine a World War One soldier using. You know, I think it's a broader approach to war, isn't it? But you know what's funny is that, so the words for this, Indifference, Miasma, press gang. So I looked into this, and press gang refers to impressment. Have you heard this? Impressment. In Britain from around the 1600s, around 1664, when they would basically force people to join the Navy. They couldn't get people to join the Navy.
Conscription.
But far more direct. So it's not like, you know, would you like to join? No, it's actually, you know, they would have people patrolling docks and harbours and just basically gathering up any sort of men, predominantly itinerant men, homeless men, and forcing them to join the Navy. And the impress service, or more common, thank you Wikipedia, more commonly called the Press Gang was employed to seize men for employment at sea in British seaports. Impressment was used as far back as Elizabethan times, when this form of recruitment became a statute, and later the Vagrancy Act, 1597, men of disrepute, usually homeless vagrants, could be drafted into service. But that continued and evolved into conscription in the 20th century. But yeah, it was very much about seizing men against their own will and sending them on to war. You know, is a big of part course. Of this. And do you know what? Yeah. I've really got into, in the last few days since we last spoke, I've got really addicted to the alternative mix of this, the Venetian mix. Yes, Henry Hay on the harpsichord. Yes. And Tony playing bass.
Yeah.
And it is...
Yes.
And I think that harpsichord just makes it... I mean, everything you said just now is true about this exceptional melody, but that harpsichord just accentuates it.
When I listen to the original one, my brain goes to, like, Vietnam War and all of those images of, you know... soldiers just getting high to deal with the horror of the situation. And it's usually, you know, that's the image I get from the music in the chorus. It's very psychedelic and also very sort of late 60s, early 70s of that era to me. So the Henry Hay harpsichord Venetian version just queers that to me and just makes it like just a little bit more surreal, which I really like. You know what I mean? Like, so rather than being a kind of literal thing where you're like, oh, I'm meant to think of that and I'm meant to think of this, having that sort of Baroque, Renaissance type, you know, Rococo type sound in there, making it very opulent and making it very European rather than American, what I was thinking before. You know, it just queers it in a really lovely way.
I didn't think of it as being American, really. I wasn't thinking of this as an American perspective. And that harpsichord, you're right, it does root it a lot more in that. And have you seen the video with that version?
The advert from Louis Vuitton? Or do you mean the video with the...
That video. Yeah, which was... Tom Hingston directed that. And he was saying, we wanted that video to feel like a found relic, discovered as if from another era. In early conversations, Mr. Bowie and I discussed exploring archival footage that brought to life another side of war. Footage that featured soldiers celebrating young servicemen and women in moments of jubilation and euphoria, drinking, dancing and partying. These moments of total euphoria, juxtaposed with extreme violence, serving as a powerful reminder of the futility of war. And so when you match that up with the Venetian version of this, with that dancing, sparkling harpsichord all the way through, it's just, as you said at the beginning, chef's kiss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, chef's kiss. Although the harpsichord version, my brain just goes straight to the Louis Vuitton advert with all of the people with masks.
That was the mask ball.
The very labyrinth ball.
Yeah. Strange choice for a Vuitton.
Yeah, so strange. It's a beautiful advert, but yeah, it is. What a weird song to put with a brand like that.
I mean, he wasn't at all sort of above advertising. I mean, I think around the same time we had Vuitton, we had Vittel. Of course, then there was Crystal Japan for whiskey. Pepsi. Yeah. I mean, come on, you know, that Pepsi ad with Tina Turner.
Oh, yeah. I love that Pepsi advert.
What was it? The so taste is fine advert. Or the taste is mine? What was it? They did Modern Love and he changed the strap line to taste is mine. Oh, what was it?
Yeah.
When you see it, it's just ridiculous. I mean, you couldn't get more 80s. Bowie is this sort of mad scientist, and Tina Turner.
It's weird science. He programs his dream woman, and out pops Tina Turner, and they strut away drinking Pepsi. It's the best thing ever. I love it. I was quite annoyed that, like, Brett Morgan framed that as some kind of, you know, nadir.
Things got really bad when Bowie then started advertising Pepsi for Tina Turner. But I need to dig out the Vuitton ad so we can see it in that context. But I think this works so wonderfully with Hingston's very that video.
Yeah, it is good.
Fits that hazy, like you said, psychedelic sort of vibe that we've got going on here. Mm. So yeah. Oh, and my favorite moment in this, I think, is the guitar line when he's underneath when he's singing. I'm 17, but my looks can prove it. You know, just that moment where the guitar comes in and it just kicks up a level, and then it ends on the teenage sex and that snarling. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, wow. Come on, chapeau. So we go from probably the best, in my opinion, the best song on the album to pretty much the worst song on the album.
Hang on, you reckon that's the best song on the album? Sorry, hold up. I'll go back.
It is right now. I'm thinking about it.
Yeah.
What would you challenge that with?
Oh, I'd have to say Love Is Lost. We talked about that last time. But yeah, no, I think the before we move on, you have to also just give props to, I guess, David, mostly for the polish on this one. This one to me sounds like he spent a lot of time on it. You know, they've got so much going on with the backing vocals in the background. Like this and Informer are just like Queen level backing vocals arrangement going on. With all these like different like cascading, like I'd rather be high, all these lovely bits of voices coming from underneath and above. It's very like, you know, Mr. Tambourine Man by the Burbs. It's very
yes.
You know,
yes, that's
lovely,
a good point.
Yeah.
Those kind of rich, lush harmonies.
Yeah, and the arrangement behind all of that, that takes time. You know, you've got to sing each of those. It's a long process.
I'm just listening to what you're saying. I'm looking at when this was recorded. So this was recorded obviously in September and then in May 2012 and then also in August 2013. So this was amongst the final batch.
Yeah.
So there must have been people coming back to this thinking, all right, let's put more on it. And it's got quite a long line. So Jerry on guitar, Tony Levin on bass guitar, Zach on drums, Tony Visconti and Henry Hay are on the Venetian mix, bass and harpsichord respectively. But it took a lot of work.
Yeah, so this is one that took a lot of time in the kitchen to get right.
Especially the different versions.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
Right, now we go.
Okay, now we're going. So, all right, so let me just clarify what I just said now. So rather than saying the best song on the album, let me say from my favourite, me personally, from my favourite song on the album, and I know my old mucker Nick Pegg says I never have favourites, but I think that really is one of my favourites, to a song which... I think, to be honest with you, Leah, I just skip over. I mean, look, this is a big album, right? You can skip a few songs. Yeah. It's not low where you've got to listen to everything. There's a lot on this album. And I think now...
It's not sacrilege to hit the skip button on this album.
It's not, is it? And I think it gets a little bit saggy around this point. You know, we've had some absolute bangers. And now we get to...
It's been all killer, no filler up to this point, though. This is number 9. I mean... 8 tracks, that's an album on its own.
Yeah. A cynic could argue he could have left things there and no one would have thought the worst of him for
it. Fast forward to You Feel So Lonely You Could Die and then you got a banger of an album.
Yeah. If you want to do that on the podcast, hit fast forward at this point. we'll see you there. We'll see you over there. But all right, so let's have a look at this. So Boss of Me, Displaced, Flight, Resettlement. I mean, after everything I've just been saying, I mean, is this a track you like? Is this a is there anything of particular note about this track for you?
No, I don't. You know, it's a bit of a B-side for me. I feel like it's a song they jammed out together, and for whatever reason, they thought it was rockin'. And, you know, it's a kind of band song. It's the kind of song that maybe would come alive in a live set. Maybe it might rock a bit more if they did it live. you know, I remember having similar feelings about some of the tracks on Reality, but it worked really well live.
Yeah.
They were a bit kind of stodgy on the record. And you're like, okay, it makes sense. It's a live song. That, like, the two Jerry songs, I feel are like that, you know. And thinking back to Jerry being the musical director the musical director for Reality Tour, it makes kind of sense. Like, this and, like, I'll Take You There just seem quite, like, live, pumping up, you know, energetic live tracks. But... Yeah, there's not much to this, aside from a riff.
It's a riff, isn't it? And it's quite a turgid riff as well. In my mind, it's quite dull, really. You know, it's not exciting. I mean, it kind of breaks out into the chorus. You've got a bit of a bit of a sloganeering chorus there, which is fine. But
I don't hate the chorus, actually. Yeah. Like, I don't mind the angle of it. That's a... You know, whoever thought of the whoever do dee, that kind of that bit at the end, it's a bit weird. And then I think as the song rolls on, every time he goes up to that weird note at the end, there's like a bigger harmony, and it's a bigger harmony. Like, his backing vocals come in and they sort of fan out. I quite like that. But then it just goes back to that riff and you're just like, ugh, to wait for this to roll around again before I get to that cool chorus bit. But I think there's a story, isn't there, that it was named after the pedal that Jerry had, this Boss ME. Yeah, he's using this bass pedal thing, the Boss ME. I think it's called the Boss ME80 or something like that. And there was a thought someone had somewhere. I think maybe Chris writes about it in his book about how maybe that's where, you know, Bowie thought, oh, that's the name of it. Thinking now, like, I'm talking on a Bluebird mic and Tony brought up the whole thing that he had a Blackstar amplifier. Like, maybe this is part of that, you know, in that part of the Bowie library, you go, songs that are related to bits of kit that he had in the vicinity.
He's just sitting in the studio, gazing blankly into space, thinking, oh my God, what am I going to write about now?
I need song ideas, quick.
Boss pedal, Bluebird mic, Blackstar amp.
Boss ME. Blackstar amp, come on, what else is there around here?
That HP,
Hewlett-Packard.
That has to be it, Boss ME. That has to be it. I was spending time, I swear to you, listening to the Malcolm in the Middle theme tune this afternoon.
No. By
They Might Be Giants, Boss of Me. And I even found that apparently the first known usage of the phrase Boss of Me comes from a church newsletter from 1883. And in that newsletter, there's a little parable about a brother and a sister. And let me see, where is it? So this is what it says. And this is from 1883. His sister was going to put her arms around him, but he whirled and, facing her with a very angry face, snapped, "Let me alone. You are not the boss of me now, I tell you, and I'm going to do as I please." That's from 1883. So I was wondering, maybe Bowie read that. But then there's also, quite a well-known poem from 1930 by the Canadian poet Isabel Eccleston Mackay, or Mackay, and it goes, "There is a tiger in our hall. He lies so flat and still. He never seems to move at all, but sometimes perhaps he will. Some day when I am grown up tall, I'll step on him. You'll see. I'll teach that tiger in our hall. He's not the boss of me."
I've heard someone talk about that online as well, that poem. But you know what? I feel in my heart
that
you can't go deep diving in such a shallow pool, Arsalan. You just can't.
Could you tell that I was trying to find something to talk about? Because I knew unless you threw me a curve and just said, "Now this is the best song on the album."
Oh, I wish I could. I wish I could pull it apart and show you some diamonds. I just don't think they're in there. I think it's a passable song. I don't think it's as terrible as what everyone makes out. I don't hate it as much as other people do. But I think just thinking back to, like, those three words, displaced, flight and resettlement, makes me think about Lazarus, particularly like the Emily Lazarus angle of the whole thing, you know, the poet and her, you know, and then the idea of sort of refugees being displaced and then going to America. And that kind of links as well to I'll Take You There, you know, What Will I Be in the USA type deal. And it makes me think that these were perhaps song lyric ideas that he sort of had in a pile that he was maybe thinking about a musical that was folding in Emily Lazarus into it. Because Emily Lazarus is something that Enda Walsh talks about in the prologue to the script, and sort of says at one point the character Ellie was supposed to be called Emily Lazarus or Ellie Lazarus, and she's supposed to think that she was the poet. And that's a whole plot point that they got rid of in the musical. But obviously it's a tenuous web, isn't it? But this idea of refugees and of being other and being othered in America, and then that linking to the story of Thomas Jerome Newton or whatever musically he was working on with Michael Cunningham, just maybe makes me think that this might have been some little remnants that he had lying around with that in mind.
It would make sense, wouldn't it? I mean, you can't imagine an artist like Bowie just, I don't know, I mean, like, yes, he has done throwaway, he has done filler, but it seems strange in such an album, which is otherwise so planned, and as we've mentioned a few times now, you know, he mulled over this for the best part of a year, the eventual track listing. It seems bizarre that this track would make it on there when, if it is such a weak track on its own, it must have been part of something. As you say, it must have been originally intended for something, and he personally just liked it or felt it was important to acknowledge that there was a project which was going to happen. I don't know, but yeah. It's
in that. If the truth comes out, or if they've got evidence of it at the David Bowie Centre for Performing Arts in Stratford, London, I would go, oh yeah, that does make sense. And I think that would, yeah, place the context of this song a little bit better, because it just doesn't feel as strong as anything else on the album. It feels like it should be on the Next Day Extra, alongside Born in a UFO and
yes.
stuff.
Yeah. Zach says of this song, there was an interview with Zach about this one, and he's talking about the bass player, Tony Levin, and he used a Chapman stick on this, which sounds like it should be for your lips, but in fact it's a guitar-like instrument played by tapping the wide fretboard, which I never knew. Okay. And Zach says, I remember Boss of Me, we cut that with Tony Levin on bass. I remember specifically thinking, oh, this one sounds kind of funky. Wouldn't it be great if he played the stick? I suggested that, and Tony wasn't thrilled with that because there were a lot of chord changes, and he doesn't like to do songs with chord changes on the stick. But everybody thought it sounded great. It almost sounded Peter Gabriel-like, like something from the Big Time era.
Hmm. Really?
I know. I've got to admit, I don't quite see that, but...
No.
You know.
Maybe I need to go back and listen harder. I'm not
well...
sure.
Let me know what you think.
I'll let you know.
You can listen to it. I've listened to it, I think, twice today, and that'll do me for now.
What's really great is, like, you go look at, like, I remember very clearly, like, when Ashes to Ashes, a Chris O'Leary book, came out, like, I was really keen to read about these ones. And, like, the comments he's making is like, the stereo mix is wide and good. He's just got nothing good to say about it. It's so
stereo
funny.
Mix is a wonderful mix. Tony did a great job.
There's depth to it. You know, he's really scrabbling around for something to say.
There are some drums so on funny. It as well. And the drums
there's
are played,
drums on it.
The drums are played with finesse. And Zachary Orford was born in the... Yeah. But
it's mid-tempo.
It's a mid-tempo classic. Well, you know, you can't win them all, can you,
no.
really? And I feel that it's an album of this length. The consensus does seem to be it sags a little bit in the middle. You know, it just gets to the point. I find it very hard, unless I'm rattling through tracks, I find it very hard to keep my attention on a listen throughout. And I always find after this point, songs don't stick in my memory so much, but I am also old, so it could be that as well. Right then, so... Well, this one does stick in my memory. Dancing Out in Space. And it is Funereal, Glide and Trace.
No one here can see you dancing face to face. No one here can meet you dancing out in space.
Something like a drowning baby. I mean,
I remember
I
Adam
trouble
Buxton
with this one.
Deconstructed this, and he was convinced that the lyrics were "big baby," something like a dancing drowning baby. Hello,
something like a drowning baby dancing out
in space. Yeah, well, that's probably more interesting than the actual lyrics.
Something like a something big baby. Yeah, it is. Big baby's definitely in there.
Big
it's
baby.
A weird song. This one. So strange.
It's not as much of a misfire as Boss of Me, but it's
you don't
not...
think so. For me, this is the one that I don't like. This is the one that I'm like, mm-mm, mm-mm.
Really? No
yeah,
redeeming
and I don't...
qualities here.
Well, and it's strange because, like, you know, Crayon on Twitter, he likes this. Like, I've seen him tweet, like, this is one of his favorite songs, and it's like, because, like, he rhymes ghost with ghost, like, right at the top. And that to me is weak, like straight away. And there's a couple places where he does rhyme the word with the same word in this song. And I remember thinking it might have been a code, and I went through and found all the songs and the moments where he did it. And no, it's just, it's trying just,
you gave it your best shot trying to
find it. I did. I was like, is there a reason?
Why is
there
so
a reason
bad?
Why it's there? But the thing that bothers me most is the synthesizer sound in this. Yeah. I just can't reconcile with it. That weird, slippery, you know, that kind of weird sound. And then, like, the reverb and the delay that blurs the chord change just makes it feel like it's so wishy-washy. There's nothing going on. The beat's really spiky and the beat's nailed down, but everything else is, like, gravy slopping around on top of it. And I don't know what it's doing. To be fair, I haven't analysed it properly. I haven't, like, sat down with it to figure out why, but, like, I have a lot of trouble with it.
But do you not find that, I know what you mean, that sort of drunken chord, that note that seems to be veering all over the place, but do you not feel that there's a sort of stylophone hint there? You know, is it doing a bit of stylophone work for us there, maybe? I'm not being too fanciful with the whole space theme and stylophones and, you know, trying to draw parallels here, but that's how it struck me, was that, you know, that I know it's not the nicest sound, but I wondered if it was mimicking the, you know, the...
Maybe.
And I know that I'm talking here to the leader of the stylophone orchestra.
Why didn't he just use a stylophone?
Well, you know, it's...
You know, they would have had one there for sure.
Yeah, it's 2012, you know, people have moved on.
the synth, I mean, I became obsessed with that synth sound, just the why question, like, why did they put that in there? It's so ugly. But then the only answer I could really get from anyone, or, you know, I asked Tony about it, was this Trinity, the Korg Trinity keyboard that he loved, that, you know, and it must have been this idea that he maybe demoed it and was just married to the idea and just needed to be there. But then it sort of becomes this sort of strange Motown-y sort of pop number underneath.
That's exactly what Tony said. He said, that's a very up-tempo one. It's got a Motown beat to it, but the rest of it is completely psychedelic. The rest of it's completely unforgettable. he says psychedelic. It's got a very floaty vibe. There's a guy called David Torn who plays guitar, who we use. He comes with a huge amount of equipment that he creates his aural landscapes. He uses them in a rock context with all that ambient sound, and he's bending his tremolo arm and all that. It's just crazy, completely crazy sound on that track.
Yeah, that crazy sound, it's so slippery and so fluid, and it just seems like it's such a odd juxtaposition to have against that nailed down rhythm underneath, and the kind of, you know, the backing vocals going about the drowning baby and stuff. It's just,
I wonder if that was the point, though, that you know, the dissonance between that nailed down and that all over the place, you know, psychedelic going on. We should do our own version of it. I think if I just do the drums and you do that. I don't know. I think sometimes I think it works when you have a very rigid, solid structure, and then you kind of scribble all over that with atonal noises and noises which kind of slither in and out of that. That could be really, really exciting. But I think in this case, not so much. Also, Tony told told the Times about this. That possibly this song is about another music artist, maybe a conglomeration of artists. You know, people have been wondering, like, maybe it's about Mick Jagger, because, you know, there's that story. And this story was, I should say, a lot of these quotes I'm finding are via the fantastic BowieBible.com.
Oh, yeah.
Which has tons and tons
of
quotes. Yeah,
shout out Bowie Bible.
These guys. So this is where I found this quote. And they, the people at Bowie Bible, speculated that he could be talking about Mick Jagger, because... If you've read anything about Live Aid, when Bowie and Jagger were trying to figure out what to do for Live Aid, they came up with the idea of doing a duet in space. So I think Harvey Goldsmith, the promoter, has a very funny story about actually having to call up NASA to see if they could send Mick Jagger up in a rocket. And that idea was being seriously entertained for a while. Then I think they had ideas that Bowie would be in London and Jagger in Philadelphia. They would do a duet. But yeah, you know, that's
dancing in the street, dancing out in space.
There you are, you see.
This idea that someone's just dancing but also dying out in space because they're drowning like a baby could be like a description of, like, Jagger's dance moves in that music video, where he's kind of doing the swim. You know, he's doing the... I don't know.
I think you're being unduly harsh on Mick Jagger, because if I remember that video... Bowie's not exactly, you know, Fontaine, is he? He's not being exactly, he's not Nureyev. I mean, he's
his high kicks are great. His flexibility. And he does that big jump from up on the height and lands.
Well, those guys in that video, they clearly
they did their own stunts.
They did their own stunts. They clearly had had a very, very good dinner that night. And so I think, you know.
Oh, look, if this song is actually a very prismatic reference of a reference to Dancing in the Street, then I'm already like 20% more on board.
Oh,
like,
there we
straight
go.
Away. There straight go. Away.
And I think the other 80% will come when you listen to the lyrics. Cutting through the water, hands upon the ghost, to the city of solid iron, through the kingdom of the boats. Send your friend away now. Let him sail back home tonight. Something like religion, dancing face to face.
Hang on, where are you getting those lyrics from? Where are you looking? Because I have the urtext here.
I think this is from Bowie.com.
I have the Barnbrook designed impenetrable lyric here, where they're all just run together. So what I have is cutting through the water, hands upon the ghost, to the city of solid iron, through the kingdom of the ghost. See, he does, he rhymes ghost.
Right, I've got boats.
In the first couplet. Yeah. Kingdom of the boats.
Yeah, I've got kingdom of the boats.
Kingdom of the ghost.
Where did I get this from? I'm sure. Do you know what? On davidbowie.com, there's definitely a few typos.
This is on
davidbowie.com.
Researchers, we need better than this. Yeah. Is Mark Adams listening? We need better than this. We need. Us researchers, I mean, they need to open up this facility in Stratford sooner rather than later.
I know. There are people out there blindly searching for a writer called Nabokov. And
listen,
boats.
I see
not
it all
ghosts.
The time. I see crazy lyrics all the time. But there's this amazing one that ended up somewhere in a book, and it was the Anna Fantasticalization, this word that he made up from If You Can See Me. And then someone wrote down as a fantastic Alsatian, as in the dog, like a fantastic dog. And amazing.
I'm actually going to look that
this
up
stuff
right
gets
now.
Printed in books, you know.
Yeah.
Like this becomes the truth after a while.
But yeah, exactly. This is the record after a while. This, you know, you think if you go to davidbowie.com, this is the absolute. Where is that? What was that word? Anna. What was it you just said now? I'm looking at if you can
Anna
see.
Anna Fantasticalization. American Anna Fantasticalization. I think it's in like the third verse of If You Can See Me. What does it say on his actual website?
This is on the actual website. If you can see me, I can see you. I could wear your new blue shoes. I should wear your old red dress and walk to the crossroads. So take this knife and meet me across the river. Just chutes and ladders. And this is the kiss. American. From nowhere to nothing. And I go way back. Children
what?
Swarm like...
American what? Nothing.
No, it just
they
says
just
American
don't have the
question
word
mark.
They don't know the own lyric? It's here.
It's literally, if you go on davidbowie.com, look
they
up
don't know
the
it.
Next day, and it just says American question mark.
Question mark.
Yeah.
See? Someone needs to sort out that website. And I'll do it for a fee. I'll do it for money.
I was literally going to say exactly the same thing. It's like, okay, well, we can do it between us. Yeah, and so Nabokov... is right there and right, I'd rather be high. So where were we? So we were talking about those lyrics. So this is the difference between it doesn't matter where you are, just as long as you are there. And then you also have something like religion, dancing face to face. So there's quite a leap there.
I mean, he evokes Rodenbach, doesn't he? So you've got another Bookie Wookie song, which... means that, you know, you can go off on a little cross-reference tangent and maybe that could really enrich the reading of the song.
I've never heard of that author before I was reading about this.
So there was the Bruges La Morte, so this book, which I ended up reading, but it didn't really give me much insight into it. It's just sort of a book about the city and like the canals, the waterways, and this sort of person who obsesses over his dead wife.
Yeah,
it's just really quite. It's about death, and it's about, you know, the sort of psychedelic liminal spaces around death, sort of where the veil is thin and all that sort of thing. Mm. Really quite, you know, imagistic. But how does that fit in with this sort of Motown Big Baby sort of context?
Drowning baby, yeah.
Yeah, but then the idea of like maybe like if someone was out in space struggling, they might look like they were dancing, which I think is quite of a macabre, grim sort of image to think of. You know, they're out the airlock and they're like digging around. You're like, oh, they're dancing out in space. But actually, no, they're just dying.
Is that like not waving but drowning? So
yeah, not waving but drowning.
Yeah, exactly.
Dancing out in space.
Dancing out in space is a very lyrical way of saying somebody who's really in trouble. Somebody who looks like they're having a great time, but in fact, they're going full on Major Tom. And yeah, that is a great reading.
Funereal glide trace.
Without a trace.
The word glide kind of fits with that book as well by Robin Buck. There's like sort of these boats,
yeah,
you know, gliding through the water. Kingdom of the ghost. Traces. Yeah, it's all that sort of haunted liminal space in that book. But
do you like it any more now? You said you liked it 20% more.
And look, you know, I would like it another 30% more if we could go back and replace that synth with a stylophone. That would be cool.
What's the name of your stylophone orchestra? Is it just the Stylophone Orchestra?
Yeah, the Kingston University Stylophone Orchestra.
Could that be something the Kingston University Stylophone Orchestra attempts?
We could do an arrangement of this. We could crack it open like a Fabergé egg and it'll just reveal all of its insides to us. Amazing.
Perfect. Yeah, you have to do that next. Okay, so moving on, and how does the grass grow? And here we have Balkan Burial Reverse.
Oh, I do like this one.
Yeah?
Yes. There's a moment in it where my eyes roll back with pleasure every time. I think it's that bit just after the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so, you know, there will be no tomorrow. And he's doing this weird thing. And then there's this drum, do-do-do-do, and then this guitar solo, meow-meow. And I was just like, oh, my tongue rolls out. I just love it. It's just... it's so heavy and so good and so satisfying and just, yeah.
It's got
it's just burning up that solo.
It's got really great guitars on this. It's very...
amazing.
It feels kind of Hero-esque, you know, like from that period, you know, like the angular guitars.
Yeah. No, I like this. I like this one.
And it's
a strange one as well because you've got that really weird sort of... ding, ding, ding. Dun, 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 dun. It's all sort of like stilted and, you know, it's jagged and weird. But then, you know, you get that wonderful sort of, you know, evocation of Apache.
Right. I was going to...
the chorus.
Where does this come from? So it seems to come out of nowhere, this rather... mocking, sneering, la 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 la, na 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 na,
yeah. I love that.
Yeah, but it's so random. This quote from Apache coming in here, you know, it just seems to just come in the bridge, and then you get this sort of very militaristic, intense, chanting, building up chorus. But what I didn't know, which is really interesting, and this is again another shout out to BowieBible.com, is the title and the chorus were adapted from Kubrick's 1987 film Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah, and the chant, right? Where they stick in the dummy bayonets and stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. And so Hartman is going, "What makes the grass grow? Blood, blood, blood. What do we do for a living, ladies? Kill, kill, kill." So, this is definitely another return to one of the recurring themes on the album, you know, war, fighting, soldiers, military, the mentality that men have to get into before killing and turning into fighting machines. And this is something that Bowie just seems to be really dwelling on this album.
Yeah, and also like the structures of war, the power structures of war, how they make monsters of men, this idea of... you know, the unfathomableness, you know, how can the grass grow? You know, this idea, like all those corpses that fill up with blood again, which is also really interesting, which I think is the burial in reverse idea from the three words. What, but the, then you've got this. But then you've got Boys Keep Swinging at the end. So you've got this, you know, boys.
Yeah.
You can wear a uniform, you know. Isn't it great to be a boy?
But then this harks back. This harks back to I'd Rather Be High. And that closeness of sex, killing, the incredible emotional cost of war, whether you're participating in it, whether you are suffering as a result of it, you know, and all, how all these emotions jostle closely to the surface. And that's definitely the case here as well, isn't it? You know, and again, he's taking a rather, he's taking a perspective on this in these songs.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It's troubling when you look at the lyrics, you know, like the song rocks. I think the chorus and the bridge, the solo is just so good. But then all these conspicuous references that are sitting there just give you pause, don't they? And the images that he draws from also, they sort of, they're poetic and they're upsetting at the same time. It's, I really like it. But I tell you what, I haven't really figured out like what it's doing here. Between
really?
These two songs. No, like between like Dancing Out in Space and You Will Set the World on Fire. You know, you would recall like before I was kind of trying to draw meanings from this, you know, positioning of the songs. But here, like, what is this song doing? You know, it's not in the war section of the album, is it? It's not next to the tyrant section. It's not next to the gun section.
But I think he weaves these themes, doesn't he? It would be rather dull if he lumped in all the war songs in one place and all the gun songs in one place and so on and so on. And I think that it is a weave. It's like a tapestry. So this will come back in at this point and then this flows in here. And then I think you pointed out a few tracks ago, which one was it you mentioned? You said you also commented on the positioning of it. Was it Dancing?
No. If you can see me.
I think it was If You Can See Me. And how the positioning of that between the songs around it worked really, really well. So obviously,
well, so does the like the Love Is Lost going into Where Are We Now goes really well.
Yeah,
this one, yeah, I haven't spent so much time with this one, really thinking about it, but it definitely does something. It, you know, and it also, one thing about this that I really like is the key that it's in, because it's in like one of the more difficult keys to play in, like B flat minor, and then it goes into D flat major, which is like, you know, if we think about like a normal key like D, it's easy to play on the guitar. It's quite bright, you know. You sort of think about colors like yellow and orange. When you think about D flat, B flat minor, it's like purple. It's like really dark blue, navy blue. And so it's like this sort of dense, murky, cold choice with the keys. And you know, again, it's like it's a very Bowie-esque thing to do, to give it a really murky sort of tonality. It's just doing so much. There's so many like layers to it. There's so many layers of self-reference there. You know, when I think about Boys Keep Swinging, I think about also just masculinity as a performed thing, you know, and I think back to what he was evoking with Boys Keep Swinging, which was that boys get all the privileges in life. And then he's bringing that idea into this song where, you know, what privilege does it give you if you've been conscripted and you're, you know, you're watering the grass with blood and you're washing your brain with these ideas.
That's a really good point to, as a sort of dark flip side of Boys Keep Swinging. I mean, and Boys Keep Swinging was silly, wasn't it? I mean, it was knowingly silly. It was very camp, and it was just very exuberant and over the top. But yes, on the flip side, you have this, is that society expects this of its young men as well. Grass will grow nourished by their blood. And as a sort of a negative image of the positive of Boys Keep Swinging. And it's very clever to wind that into this song towards the end, and I think that's perhaps what he's getting at. What we're looking at, these themes that recur throughout the album, the jingoistic celebration of men going off to fight, and then this as the bleak inevitable consequence.
Yeah, I like that a lot. You know, the Apache thing by the Shadows. You know, it to me it makes me think of like surf rock and you know, youth and teenage men at the beach, you know, that kind of thing. It reminds me of, you know, the post-war generation enjoying their leisure time to Apache, as performed by the Shadows. And then here sort of, you know, being applied to this story of young men plunging their bayonets into these dummies.
The timeline, especially, it was, I think, what was Apache, 1960, 60, 61? I think it was definitely around that time. I think that would have also spoken to when, certainly when Bowie was a young man, Pashy would have had that cartoonish image of Native Americans at that time.
Yes.
You know, the rather corny...
The heroes and the villains. And
right,
the,
exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. So maybe that was a reference to, of, you know, like how a boy sees the goodies and the baddies or fighting. I don't know. But, you know, it's certainly
Cowboys and Indians.
Cowboys and
Indians.
It's just
the game that young boys play. Yeah, yes. It could be.
Yes. Where's that from? Where's that quote from? Cowboys and Indians is just a game that young boys play. I'm sure that's a lyric, right?
Is it? I don't know. I just said it.
The way you said it, it sounded just like a lyric. That's so weird. That's
maybe it's like, maybe it's seeped into my head like, yeah. sort of like a George sort of My Sweet Lord moment where I've just absorbed it.
And that was Leah Cardos and I waffling on at length about The Next Day, and we will be back for more soon as we need to round off the album and also, of course, look at all the bonus cuts that came out on The Next Day Extra. So in the meantime, please do let me know what you think of the album. It does tend to get overlooked a little bit by the looming big dark shadow of Black Star, but even though I do maintain that The Next Day sags a bit in the middle, I have fallen in love with it all over again, and so I hope this has likewise prompted you to revisit and reappraise too. So till the next time, that's all for me, and goodbye for now.